Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is March 24th, 2009. We're going to go out of order on the agenda and have open a work session on House Bill 2584. I'd like to call Mr. Boss, if I could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2584 allows a plaintiff to bring an antitrust lawsuit if they are an indirect purchaser. We heard this on March 11th. It has no revenue impact, has minimal fiscal impact, and there is no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Boss, I want to ask you a couple of questions. What is the view of the Attorney General's Office on the hiring of special assistant attorneys general to prosecute indirect purchaser cases on behalf of Oregon consumers? And would this allow the Attorney General to prosecute all such meritorious cases?
Thank you, Chair Barker. For the record, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. The Attorney General has not appointed any special assistance Attorney General in the past to prosecute indirect purchaser cases on behalf of the Oregon consumers. There are no current plans to do so in the future. The part of the reasoning behind this is it does take time to and FTE from our section to monitor the activities of the special assistance attorneys general, so that there would be some lost opportunity costs for us in our relatively small antitrust group to take the time to go out and to monitor these special assistance attorneys general.
Okay. Could you describe the Attorney General's position on what would happen if competing cases were filed on behalf of the same Oregon consumers, one by private counsel and one by the Attorney General?
It would be our position in that, Chair Barker, it would be our position in that case that because we are the statutory representatives of consumers, of the people of the United States, that are, especially if they were simultaneously filed or filed near in time with each other, that the Attorney General action should take precedent over the private action.
And does the Attorney General plan to substantially expand its antitrust enforcement activity on behalf of the Oregon indirect purchasers?
Well, Chair Barker, the Attorney General does allocate, it has limited resources. The Attorney General's offices have limited resources to prosecute these actions. Currently, we have two FTE attorneys that do prosecute antitrust cases on behalf of the state. And it's up to the Attorney General to try and allocate his resources. Currently, I don't believe an expansion is planned, although we do have some a policy package in the works. It is really, there are so many cases that really is not, given our limited resources, we can't really investigate and certainly can't prosecute all the actions that, indirect actions that are out there.
Thank you. Anybody else have questions for Mr. Boss? Representative Krieger.
The policy package that's in the budget.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, correct.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
What's the dollar figure?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I don't have the information right now, but I can certainly provide that to you.
Follow up.
And the policy package would help you do what this bill requires you to do, might require you to do?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, it gives the unit, which is our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Unit, it gives them 8 extra FTE. 2 of those are assistant attorneys general. It could, assuming that the Attorney General's office would want to direct the use of those in that area, it could do that. I don't know whether there's any plans to do this in currently.
Follow up again, please.
There's no referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, it's a minimal fiscal impact, and this session that's considered less than $10,000.
It's amazing, Mr. Chair, when agencies don't want something to have a fiscal impact, they don't. If they didn't, this thing would be $200,000-$300,000. I can tell you that already, and I've seen it for the last 9 years, and I really somewhat offended when I see that happening, because this body, as legislators, need to have the facts to have good policy, not things have jury-manded so that we don't know the facts.
Representative Shields?
I don't think I'll address Representative Krieger's comments, but council might want to about the makeup of the bill. But I just wanted to get on the record that the Attorney General has come to me to talk about three primary priorities of his. One is on environmental enforcement. Another is on task force on child pornography, as well as the civil rights. And so I just wanted to mention that he has a very healthy and ambitious agenda to put forward in Ways and Means. And it seems to me like if we were going to go to provide more funding for attorneys general or special attorneys general, that this would fall down farther on his priority list. At least that's my impression. And I'm not asking a question, but I just wanted to get that record on the comment on the record.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Fred. Actually, this is a question that spins off of what the chair asked you earlier, and it deals with the whole issue of the pursuit of duplicative action. What would your thoughts be should, or considering if you have a consumer pursuing the manufacturer and then also the attorney general stepping in as well because of the possibility that a number of other attorney generals across the state have developed evidence that have been overwhelming and supportive to want to pursue that. I guess that's a question, but the piece that I want with that is, do you see the potential with this bill of maybe amending it to a point where it would be real clear that in a case involved in that set of circumstances where the attorney general's decision would be to supersede that of consumers?
Chair Barker, Olson. It certainly would be if the two actions, a private action and one from the Department of Justice, were filed anywhere simultaneously or concurrently, that the one on behalf of the Attorney General should take precedence, because we by statute do represent the citizens of the state of Oregon and thus the consumers of the state of Oregon. So it would certainly be our position when it came time for a certification of the class that our action should take precedent over theirs. That's not in the statute, and it's not, I don't believe it's in the ORS, but that would certainly be our legal position.
Yeah.
So, okay, just clarification then, Mr.
Clarification,
Chair.
Please.
So, Fred, that would help greatly if that just clarified that then in the statute.
I don't believe it's currently in the statute.
If we tweaked it to that direction.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I don't believe it hurt.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Discussion?
Representative Barton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just regarding Representative Olson's question, which is an excellent one, I strongly suspect that kind of question of law has been resolved elsewhere, and I don't necessarily think it needs a statutory fix. That said, I wish Representative Garrett were here, because he's more familiar with this area of law than I. But even if it's not resolved right now in current law or current practice, I think the federal judge would have quite a bit of influence on that at the time. Again, that's frankly all I can say at this time. I just don't know more.
Yes.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think everyone here in our job is to protect the consumers, but I think that we have the Attorney General. We've set it up. Now, we've talked about the number of states that are doing it with the Attorney General, including Washington and our neighbors, Idaho and Utah. And at this time, I do not think that we've got a way to protect the consumers, and I think this is just going to be anti-business, hurting the economy, and I'll be a no, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, is there a motion on the table?
There's not. Okay. Not yet.
Representative Stigler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just sort of as a adjunct to what Representative Wisnett has said, for some of the very reasons that he stated, I will support this because I think, quite frankly, it's not just the ultimate purchaser or consumer that I think this protects, but it protects a class of folks in between, i.e., the retailer down here. It's not just the consumers and the businesses, but it's also the retailer. And I think this could be an added boon to small business, quite frankly, to protect themselves. And they're oftentimes the entities in this chain of this retail chain who are left out in the cold. So for some of the very reasons that Representative Wisnett indicates that he will vote against it, I will be in favor of it.
Okay.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I have to respond.
Mr. Chair, I know we don't have a motion, so we're not talking about our votes here, but I don't believe I was looking for testimony from small businesses that are coming forward saying they're being harmed by us not passing this bill today, and I didn't hear any of that. And I think sometimes we do this in the name of protecting people who are today don't feel they need the protection, and it opens doors for a lot of other things that unintended consequences that may actually harm business in this state. And I think during these days of 236,000 unemployed Oregonians, we need to be very careful of everything that we do in here that sure protects the citizens of our state, but also allows for opportunity for employment. So I guess I will be a no on this, okay, too.
Mr. Chair. I appreciate what Representative Barton shared and also what Mr. Boss shared as well. And I would feel a lot more comfortable myself, and I think we're probably past that stage right now in this committee, for just wanting to do a little bit of a fix there for an amendment. But at this point right now, moving forward with the bill as it's written, I'm going to vote no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. to comment about what this does for small business. I think in these type of instances where two manufacturers are working in collusion to fix prices, to allow only the wholesaler some kind of remedy, when it would seem to me clearly that that the retailer might be harmed even more so than the wholesaler, it's very important to put on the record. And also, I think we also need to keep in mind that we shouldn't assume that just because small business people aren't coming out of the woodwork demanding justice on this front that it won't affect them. I think instances like this are similar to what happens in healthcare. You don't really realize you've got a problem until you get sick. And I think we shouldn't presume that just because some of the big big business lobby groups haven't come out against this, that therefore each small business in our district wouldn't like the idea. I think small business people are incredibly busy running their own businesses, particularly in this type of environment, and don't have the wherewithal to pay a whole lot of attention to what happens down here.
Okay, thank you. Further business. I'm going to not move the bill today, and we'll take another look at it and see if there can't be some accommodations that might work. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2584. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2537.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2537 enacts the Uniform Power of Attorney Act. It provides a method for executing valid power of attorney, makes power effective even if the principal is incapacitated, allows for a springing power of attorney, and provides alternative methods to authorize if the principal is incapacitated, provides rules for termination, allows for agents' reasonable compensation, describes agents' duties and liability, limits agents' authority because of dishonesty or abuse, provides process for agent resignation, allows banks to rely on the power of attorney, describes situations for rejecting power of attorney, describes grant of authority for agents' power, provides form, authorizes conservator to revoke, provides definitions, and makes exceptions. There is a dash one amendment that removes all references to domestic partnership. There's no revenue impact, and I don't have any information on the fiscal impact yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think before we even hear, I'd like to have a motion to introduce the dash one amendments. Representative Shields.
Representative Barker, I move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2537.
Chair, are we in a work session or a public hearing?
I'm sorry, thank you. We're in a public hearing. I'm going to open a work session to do that, and then we'll go back to public hearing. Thank you.
To restate my motion, Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2537.
Representative Shields moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2537. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2537. Mr. Cohen, Mr. Sherman, and Ms. Grimes, please. If the people who are for this, if you want to do it in a different order, that's fine with me. If this will work, okay.
Okay.
I'm sorry, there's no name on this hearing. I thought we had three people, and we have six.
We can move up.
Four, five. Please proceed anywhere you wish. Just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Wayne Shetterly. I'm pleased to be back with you today. As you know from my last appearance before you a couple of weeks ago, I am one of the four commissioners from Oregon on the Uniform Law Commission, and I'm here just to introduce this bill to you. Because it is a uniform law, it comes out of the Uniform Law Commission. And I want to give you some context and background on that. To ask the question that Representative Garrett would ask if he was here, how many states have adopted this and what's the status of the bill in the other states? You've checked. Yeah, two states have adopted. It's a relatively new bill, 2006. As of this year, there have been 10 introductions in legislatures meeting around the country. Bills are in various stages of the process. In Virginia, the bill has passed both houses. So there's the status of the National Action on the Uniform Power of Attorney Act. Just very briefly, by way of background, some of you, I'm sure, know very well, and some of you probably have general concepts of what a power of attorney is. It's a form of agency. It's a document by which an individual, the principal, can designate an agent in the document known as the attorney, in fact, to exercise certain rights with regard to the finances and businesses of the principal. It's commonly used in my law practice and I think others as a means of providing for client life planning, so that in the event of incapacity or absence, a person can designate another person, a trusted individual, to manage their affairs. You have a general power of attorney, which is a very broad form, typically what a husband would give to a wife and wife to a husband and maybe a parent to a child, that would allow broad exercise of powers on behalf of the principal. And you have limited powers of attorney that are specific for certain types of transactions. On a personal level, I am an attorney, in fact, for my mother. She signed a power of attorney in 1987, and I am still managing her affairs under that power of attorney. The benefit to her which is typical of a power of attorney, is that it has avoided the cost to her of a guardianship or a conservatorship in this case, as she has become unable to manage her affairs. It's a very inexpensive way to provide for that kind of management of personal, financial, and business affairs of somebody who is in need of assistance. The reason you have a uniform act here is that states have been all over the board in terms of what their laws provide. If you look at current Oregon law on powers of attorney, it's almost vacant. We have a handful of statutes on powers of attorney that have just kind of grown over the years, not as a concerted class of statutes, but they've been amended off and on over the years. I guess I would say minimalist regimen of statutes today that govern powers of attorney in Oregon. Other states have more robust statutes governing powers of attorney, but it was really uneven. And the idea of a uniform act to address powers of attorney is recognizing that we're a mobile society and that we own assets often in several states. There is a benefit to having a more uniform system so that a person who executes a power of attorney in Oregon and moves to Colorado can know that that power of attorney will be recognized and effective in Colorado without having to go get another one made, or worse yet, finding out too late that it's not effective in Colorado. And also, where you have a person who lives in Oregon, but has, many of us do, have assets in several states, the portability of these powers of attorney is important to be able to make them useful. There are certainly, and you'll hear about it in testimony today, risks whenever you authorize somebody to take actions for you and manage affairs. I think you'll hear from the district attorneys concerns about identity theft and fraud and mismanagement. I can't discount that, but I can say that in my own practice and from my understanding of the literature and studies, powers of attorney have the utility of powers of attorney and the benefit that they provide as low-cost and useful planning devices has just been outstanding across the country for all the years that they've been on the books. These are not new powers at all. This act really is intended to provide a uniform base of laws for states to adopt to be able to manage those, recognizing protections for principals, guidance for agents who are using them, and also guidance for people who are asked to recognize a power of attorney. That's all in this bill. I want to thank the Bankers Association in this case for taking the lead in introducing the Power of Attorney Act, but I do commend it to you. Thank you for your consideration of it today. Thank
you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. With me today are two representatives of two of our member banks, Linda Thomas-Bush in the red on the opposite end of the table is from U.S. Bank, and Kathy Grimes is the operations manager for M Bank up in Gresham. And they'll speak to you after I've completed my testimony. Lane has done an excellent job, I think, of laying out the subject matter for this, that I think most of us are at least vaguely familiar with powers of attorney, and those of us who practice law in a general kind of a practice are dealing with these pretty much on a daily basis, particularly in connection with estate planning. They've proved over the years to be an extremely useful device to avoid the cost and the burdens of setting up conservatorships for particularly elder people, but sometimes for younger people who become financially incapable. And so they save a lot of court time and a lot of court supervision, and by and large, they work very well. Do they work perfectly? No, as with any other institution invented by man, they are not perfect, but they do play a very useful role. As Lane said, though powers of attorney are in wide use in Oregon and have been as long as I've been in practice, we don't have much in the way of law about powers of attorney. In fact, I brought the whole thing with me, one side, less than one page. That's all the statutes that we have in Oregon on the subject of powers of attorney today. And I'll tell you that most of what's written on that one page is provisions that protect the interests of my clients. In fact, the one thing that this law does a pretty good job of right now is to protect the interests of the third parties who are presented powers of attorney. And that's where I'm coming from. That's where the Banking Association is coming from. Our role in all of this is not usually as the principal who executes the power of attorney. It's not as the agent who is given the power, although that sometimes happens. But most often, we are in the role of receiving a power of attorney and being asked to act upon it and rely on it. So that's our interest in this. And as I say, our existing Oregon statute does a pretty good job of protecting our interests. And if you look at that part of the bill that speaks to the third party and the liability and the responsibility of the third party, there's basically a transfer of the substantive rules from our existing Oregon law into the Uniform Act and House Bill 2537 on that issue. What is missing from our law today is anything that even begins to protect the interests of the other parties, particularly the principal under power of attorney. If you look at the words on this page, you're not going to find much at all that speaks to the protection of the interests of the principal from fraud and abuse and that sort of thing. And there's a lot built into the bill that we're introducing to you today that is designed to do exactly that. So whatever you take away from this, I think it's important to remember that our starting point is basically at ground zero in terms of protecting consumer interests and rights. And anything we do, almost anything we could do here in the Oregon legislature is going to be a significant improvement over that. You're going to hear in a while from the representative from American Association of Retired Persons. They did a study just in November, and I'm not going to steal Jerry Cohen's thunder, but I want to point out that if you look at this, and I'm going to leave a copy of this study for your review, if you go to page 28, they have a lengthy chart, many pages long, that talks about what are the protections that one finds in the Uniform Power of Attorney Act that has just been put out by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. What are the protections in there for consumers? And what of those protections are found in the various state laws? If you look at page 28 on this study, you'll find that Oregon doesn't fill the bill on any one of those protections, not a single one. We're one of only four states that falls into that category. So we've got a long way to go to improve upon that. So we started with this uniform draft, and I brought a copy because, lest I forget to say this later, when we introduce uniform legislation in Oregon, we always try and make sure that the comments, the official comments that are put into the act by the drafters are made a part of your record, because they do a great job of explaining what the meaning of the words in the law are. And so I want to be sure to ask that this be made a part of your record, and I'll give it to your clerk when we get done here. At any rate, we took that, and then we spent a considerable period of time, and I don't just mean we, the Oregon bankers. We had input from a lot of other folks trying to make it even better. And by and large, what we did was to try and add some important protections into the law that we thought were missing. And I'll get to detailing those in a bit. The bill is broken into four parts, and my job here before you is to give you a brief explanation of what this bill consists of and kind of a roadmap by which you can examine on your own time. The first part of this bill is what is titled General Provisions, and it includes such things as definitions of terms, the rules for formalities for signing a power of attorney, the rules for terminating a power of attorney, the rules that set forth the agent's authority, the rules on the duties of agents, the liability of agents, and the liability of third parties. All of those are found in the first 24 sections, roughly, of the Act. And so that's where you're going to go to find the rules of the road, so to speak, for powers of attorney. All of the rules that we don't have in place here in Oregon now are to be found there. Sections 19 and 20 of this Act are particularly important, and as we went through the Act and constructed House Bill 2537, we spent a lot of time working on those sections. Section 19 essentially restates the conditional protection that third parties, such as financial institutions, operate under, and the protections that are now found in ORS 127.035, one of the statutes on this page of existing law. To have those protections under both the existing law and this new bill, the third party must act in good faith and without actual knowledge that there's something wrong with regard to the either the power of attorney itself or the manner in which it's being used. Now, that's basically the rules of the road under Section 19. Section 19 also gives third parties, such as banks, some new tools. One of the things that they can do is to, when they are presented with a power of attorney, and there's something about it that they don't understand or don't feel comfortable with, they can ask for certain things. They can ask for an English translation if the thing is written in some other language, or they can ask for a legal opinion on any point of law that might come up, or they can ask the person, the agent who is presenting the power of attorney, for a certification, a sworn statement by the agent with regard to any material fact relating to the power of attorney. And then they can take that information and further evaluate it to make sure that they're comfortable in accepting the power of attorney that's been presented. Now, Section 20 has attracted a lot of attention because that's the section that says that under very limited circumstances, a third party, such as a financial institution, will be legally obligated to accept a power of attorney. And I want to spend just a minute or two to be sure that you fully understand how we read that section. We were very concerned when we first became aware of this and saw Section 20 in the bill because financial institutions and other third parties today have an unlimited ability, or almost unlimited ability, to say no to any power of attorney that's presented to them. The only limitation on that ability today is that there's a statute on this page that says we cannot reject a power of attorney based solely on the age of the instrument, the fact that it's 5 or 10 or 20 years old. We can't use that as the sole basis on which to say no. We didn't want to lose any of the flexibility that we have because we recognize that powers of attorney can be misused. And so we wanted to continue to have all the flexibility that was reasonably possible to be able to say no under circumstances in which it would be inappropriate to do otherwise. So we amended and narrowed the focus of this Section 20 that says in some cases you got to say yes. We said that you can say that Section 20 applies only where the statutory form of power of attorney is used. If you walk in with a power of attorney that's written on the back of a napkin or on a Stevens Nest form, no offense to the publisher, from any other source other than out of this law, with all of its protections, then there's no restriction on our ability to say no. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Section 20 only applies where the principal's signature, that's the person giving the power, where that signature has been both notarized and witnessed by two independent witnesses, the same requirement that we have in Oregon for the witnessing of a will. Third thing is those witnesses have to sign an affidavit as to the facts and circumstances under which they witnessed the signature and that the person appeared not to be acting under duress or anything like that. So they've got to sign that affidavit. And finally, we can say no unless the power of attorney has been countersigned by the agent, so that we have a specimen signature that we can use in comparison, and so that we have a statement over, or a signature over a statement that the agent understands that he's accepting this power and bound by the responsibilities of the law. So we added all of those protections. But even if we get over all those hurdles, there's still 10 other bases built into Section 20 on which we can say no to a statutory form power of attorney that is presented to us if we're not comfortable with the circumstances. And so, and that's a substantial expansion of the basis upon which you can say no over what you'll find in the Uniform Act. So we think we've narrowed the focus of that and made it very easy for a bank or for any other third party that has the slightest discomfort with what's being presented to turn it down. Finally, and I think certainly not less significantly, we said as to the remedy, that if you wrongfully reject a power of attorney, that the only things that can happen is that the court can mandate that it be accepted, which would be fine with us because now we've got a court saying that power of attorney is okay. That's the first thing. The second thing is we can be held liable for the agent's attorney fees and costs. But under our version of the bill, that can happen only if the court finds that the bank or the other third party did not act in good faith. So we think there's very little restriction on the freedom that a financial institution or any other third party is going to have on the ability to say no. Moving on, the second part of the bill, and I'll move much more quickly through the last three parts of this bill. The second part is the part where you find collected all the authorities that can be given to an agent. There's a very carefully drawn description of each kind of authority. For instance, authority over the principal's real property, your personal property, your bank accounts, and so forth. Very carefully constructed provisions that the principal can bring into bear in the power of attorney form. The third part is extremely important. That's the statutory form of power of attorney. This is not the only form you can use. All the old forms are still just fine. It's only that under our act, the statutory form that is found in this bill will be given the special protection in Section 20, the very limited special protection that I just described. But Section 41 sets out the uniform form, and I think you'll find that it's very carefully constructed, again, to protect the consumer. And here, I think we made improvements over the uniform draft. For example, if you look at Section 41, you'll see when you get to the grant of general authority, the uniform draft just has one column of places for the principal to initial. I grant this power. I grant that power. I grant the other power. We put in a second box saying I don't grant that. And we did that after much consideration, realizing that if you just had a form that had the I do grant and somebody came back and forged the initials after the fact of the principal, that would be taken as a grant of power. With our additional column on the right-hand side there, we make that much more difficult to accomplish. We also, as I mentioned before, added places for the signature of the power of attorney or of the principal to be witnessed and for the witness to sign an affidavit and for the agent to accept the power of attorney. The last part of the bill is the conforming amendments, and I won't bother to go into the details on those. Those are just amendments that we've made to existing statutes to bring them into conformity with the Act. As I said earlier, we spent a lot of time, several years actually, working on this bill with a lot of different participants. I think the effort has always been to create a balance, to create a balance where we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We maintain the utility of powers of attorney, which are extremely valuable to our clients and to all of us, but at the same time build as much as we can in the way of protections into the law. Whatever you may say of this bill, and I'll tell you it's not perfect, it is a whole lot better than what we have on the statutes today here in Oregon. We think it's a big improvement, and we hope you'll give it your careful consideration. And at that point, I'd like to turn it over to Kathy or Linda's going to go first. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Thomas Bush. For the last 32 years, I've been with U.S. Bank as a vice president and a senior trust officer. U.S. Bank is the sixth largest commercial bank in the United States with $266 billion in assets and over 15 million clients. Now, obviously, with that many clients, we're accepting some powers of attorney. We're presented them daily. We don't track how many we receive, but we are presented with them. We have one that is designed by the bank for use only with a checking or a savings account, but many times we receive a durable or a general power of attorney. I would say we don't track them, but I would say that probably 98% of those are accepted. I had a power of attorney for my aunt, and I did not have a problem having that power of attorney honored. With that, I was able to sell her real estate in Florida and manage her stocks and bonds, no problems at all. There, You may hear some people want to have mandatory acceptance of a power of attorney, requiring third parties to accept the power of attorney. And let me tell you why I don't like that. A personal situation I had with one of our branches in Roseburg a few years ago. The client there, she was out of the country on vacation. Before she went out of the country, she went into the branch, told her banker that she was going to be leaving the country. She gave her son a power of attorney. While she was gone, the son came in and wanted to close her accounts. The banker called me and said, I don't feel good about this. I know this client, and I don't think she would want that. And I said, well, could the son say that she was in dire need of money? Is he going to wire some money to him? No, he wasn't going to do that. And I said, if you don't feel good about it, then you have the ability to not honor the power of attorney. And so she didn't. When the client returned, she came into the branch, had no idea her son would have done that. And so the ability of the bank to be able to decline use of that power of attorney protected the client. Now, can fraud be committed with a power of attorney? Absolutely. You know, you are putting somebody in the position of being able to manage your financial affairs for you, and you have to be able to trust that person. When a power of attorney is used in the case of a bank, the person, the attorney in fact, or the agent, is going to bring that power of attorney into the bank, and they're going to ask the bank to accept it, and they're going to have to sign another signature card. My experience is when somebody wants to commit fraud or forgery, they're not going to go through that effort. They're going to find the blank checkbook and just forge the signature, or they're going to intercept the mail and just put those checks into an ATM, deposit them that way, and chances are they're going to sail through. And it's much easier, quicker way if you're going to commit fraud and forgery. As Ken mentioned and Lane, the current law is pretty sketchy. This statutory form, one thing that I really like about it is in the very beginning it has important information, and it is telling the principal what they are doing. Some people, in my experience in talking to clients who are thinking about giving a power of attorney, they don't really realize all the powers that they are conveying to somebody else. And they think, well, they can't do that. You know, they can't write themselves a check. Well, yes, they can. And so this form outlines in the very beginning the seriousness of the form. And I really like that. It requires that the principal signing that power of attorney be competent. That's kind of logical, but it wasn't in the previous law. It has better guidance for both the principal and the agent. And I like the fact that the agent has to sign it acknowledging what they're going to do and not do with the power of attorney. It has a specific process to revoke the power of attorney. And it contains the guidance and protections of a third party accepting it. Lastly, it is legislation. As Ken pointed out, there's one page of legislation. It's a very, very common form that people use and will continue to use and should use. This legislation just is very much needed, and it is well supported by professionals. We had in the work group to create this bill, we had everybody that we could think of at the table to provide input. Did we always agree? No. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. But we compromised on all of the areas that we didn't agree eye to eye. And it's supported by consumer organizations. So we do request that you pass this bill.
Thank you. Hello, Chairman Barker and committee. My name is Kathy Grimes. I'm the Director of Operations for MBank, which is a 13-year-old institution out of Gresham. We have $300 million in assets. We have five offices throughout the metro area. And being at a community bank, we generally know our customers quite personally. We have sometimes when a principal comes in, someone comes in with the power of attorney, we know them quite well. Sometimes maybe they haven't been in a branch office for quite a while, and to our knowledge of the customer and an understanding of their circumstances, we attempt to make decisions on the powers of attorney that are brought to us. The proposed statutory form offers a lot of guidance for the principal as well as responsibilities for the agents, so they clearly should have no doubt what their responsibilities are, and very needed guidance for financial institutions and other parties that may be asked to accept them. And the consumers, as Ken spoke to consumers as they're completing this form and making very specific decisions of what sort of power they're going to give the agent, is an educational process for them, whereas they perhaps in the past haven't realized how far an agent could go in handling their affairs. So it is a very simplified form, and the guidance that goes with it is simple and easy to use for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, and I'm not perhaps for Lane or for Mr. Sherman. I frankly don't know. I'm most first of all, this is an area of law that is crying out, I think, for a uniform code. And this is, I once in my practice had to litigate a case in which an Idaho-based principal delegated authority to an Oregon resident. The form was executed in Washington, and there was a lot of money at stake. It was a disaster. So I'm delighted that the conference has filled that void. That said, there is also a very big difference, I think, between being one of the first adopters of a uniform code and being the last adopter. And I recognize we're at the front end. We don't fully know potential unintended consequences of this. Perhaps have not been threshed out yet. I'm mindful of that. But my question now is where this diverges from the uniform code. I'm curious to see if there are any substantive distinctions, and also, if possible, I'm assuming you're going to tell me that there's not a substantive distinction. Would it be possible to get some kind of red line or a delta view between the Oregon version and the uniform code?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, we've already provided to you a section-by-section summary of the bill. I hope that is in front of you or coming around. And that actually, there's some italicized notes scattered through that describe the differences, the places where we departed. For example, in Section 2, you'll note a little note at the end of discussion of Section 2 that we added a definition of the term business day. It's not my testimony. There's another... we added a definition of business day, and that note is noted in the italicized type. We did that all the way through the bill. As to your question of whether there are substantive differences, I think the substantive differences are the additional protections that we added for consumers, the witnessing of a power of attorney as well as the notarization, the affidavit for the witness. If you look at Section 20, where in I think it's subsection 5, where it lists the bases upon which a third party may say no to a power of attorney, the last four or five of those are of our own making. They're not part of the uniform bill. And I think that's all described in those italicized notes. So hopefully that section by section will provide you with a good guide to that.
If I may, Madam Chair? Mr. Chair, I wasn't sure who he handed the gavel to.
He handed it to Representative
Representative Barton. It's interesting. Uniformity is more of a box than a point. And so in many states, as here in Oregon, when a group, especially if it's a group outside of the commission itself, one of the commissioners, takes on a uniform act, there will be some tailoring of that uniform law to the law of the state. In this case, I want to thank Ken for bringing me in early in their development of this bill, because that allowed me to engage the Chicago staff from the Uniform Law Commission that keeps track of these things. They were involved in all, I don't want to say all, but most of the meetings by telephone, even up until last week. Because there is a point at which you can stray so far from a Uniform Act that you really have to peel the uniform off of the label and just say, well, it's a good law, let's pass it. At this, based on the participation from Chicago and the staff that is in charge of this uniform law, this is still within the ambit of uniformity that satisfies the Uniform Commission that it is, in fact, a uniform act.
Questions? Thank you.
Any questions? Why wasn't this done as an Oregon Law Commission? Now, do you know?
Yes. Mr. Chair, that's a good question. I would say, and here, let me put my Law Commission hat on. For one thing, I found out about it when the bankers were already up and running with the thing. And so rather than create another train, we got on theirs. And also, it's a capacity issue. Oregon Law Commission, of course, receives assignments from the legislature to take on projects and receives proposals from several sources, actually, and tends to get a full agenda pretty early in a biennium. And so when a bill like this comes out from somebody other than the Oregon Law Commission, we try to get engaged with it, and that's what's happened here. In fact, you'll notice over the years, the Bar Association, for instance, has been the sponsor of several uniform acts. So they come from all different sources. Like I said, I just try to keep track of where they're coming from, and either one, me or one of our other commissioners track with them. And that was the case in this bill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cohen. Yeah. Mr. Cohen?
They're all in the rest of my office.
Yeah, if you want here, one up.
This is only one of my
six. Please. Oh, very good. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Cohen. I'm state director for AARP, formerly known as the American Association of Retired Persons. We are an organization that advocates for successful aging for a person's age 50 plus, although I can point out you can join at any age, and we have some younger members, younger than age 50. Again, successful aging in terms of community service, advocacy, education, outreach of issues of aging, and last but not least, member-valued products and services. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to say a few words. There's some written testimony, so I'm going to try to do the abbreviated version, and indeed, already our previous testimony, and Lane Shatterly and Ken Sherman and others have covered my intro remarks as to the necessity to address this issue and the fact that we do need to move forward. I do have some important differences in terms of concerns that AARP wants to raise, but again, I want to be very clear that we do support the Act and this bill. And again, I think, not to beat this, you're going to hear again more testimony, but the Balancing Act that we're clearly facing here when it comes to the definite value of certainty, when it comes to cost-effective autonomy, avoiding guardianship, cost-cutting, family involvement and surrogate decision-making, but at the same time avoiding and recognizing the risk when it comes to abuse. And it's a show prop. It's already been shared, I believe, with you all, but I'm very proud of the fact that at the end of last year, AARP, working actually over several years with the American Bar Association, issued a public policy report, so it's already been cited. Much to my surprise and chagrin, I was actually involved in some of the development of what would be useful for committees, so I'll appreciate your feedback because I guess I'm listed as one of the advisory committees that came up with the approach and format of this report. Beyond that, what I'd like to do is quickly guide you through why AARP believes it's important to move forward now. Certainly, as already mentioned, we can't prevent bad actors. We know that when it comes to committing theft and other types of abuse, kind of like the story of Willie Sutton, for those of us perhaps old enough to remember, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Well, we recognize and understand those dangers. But we also know and recognize that this Uniform Act approach really does provide some certainty in terms of both prevention and certainty in terms of use. A couple quick points is it makes mandatory and default duty. It contains mandatory and default duties that prohibit self-dealing and mandate preservation of the principles of state plan. Second, it makes clear that a power of attorney terminates when the principal dies.
It creates agent liability for damages equal to the sum that would be necessary to restore the estate to what it would have been without breaches of duty. And a fourth point is, and indeed is pointed out with the statutory form here, with a uniform format there's a greater amount of certainty in terms of what people can rely upon. Now, again, to be clear, this bill is not an exact replica of the Uniform Power of Attorney Act, and I certainly can vouch for the fact that it has been a product of several years of dialogue among numerous stakeholders. But it's clear that we're never going to reach total consensus, so let me move and identify a few points where AARP has some concerns. And these are actually prepared as being a national organization. We want to be clear, well, what we say here in Oregon is consistent with what we say in other states. And there are other states, as already pointed out, that are also addressing the Uniform Act. The comments come in particular from a consultant of AARP and a reporter on the Act, Linda Witten, who is a law professor at Valparaiso. So if know where these citations are coming from. The first before you is that the House Bill 2537 would give a conservator the same power as a court to revoke a power of attorney. And again, the Act itself, as prepared, was intentionally crafted to reserve the power to the court alone. Second concern is that House Bill 2537, as written, would allow a third person who suspects financial exploitation to reject a power of attorney, but it does not condition protection for this rejection by making a report to the, in this case, Oregon Department of Human Services, Adult Protective Service Unit, or law enforcement agency. Again, pointing out that it was very, very much the consideration of the preparers, the commission, in preparing the Uniform Act to note how important it was to report suspected abuse. Now, with that, I do have to note that Oregon, again, has been a leader in terms of cooperation and education done by the Oregon Bankers Association, the Oregon Department of Justice, the Oregon Department of Human Services, and AARP when it comes to what bank employees do know, what they can do, what they should do when it comes to tracking abusive, fraudulent practices and reporting. Third point under House Bill 2537 is that it would give the agent who has authority with respect to, quote, banks and other financial institutions, unquote, default power to grant security interest in the principal's real property. And again, the intent of the Uniform Act was to segregate the power areas of authority so that the principal could make knowing choices among the various delegation of powers. Fourth, House Bill 2537 would give any agent who has the authority with respect to, quote, personal and family maintenance, end quote, default power to use any asset of the principal for performance of powers enumerated in the section. And again, the idea here from the Uniform Act was to segregate also that the concern we have is that the proposed Oregon modification could undermine the ability of the principal to keep certain assets protected from dissipation either by omitting such authority from the power of attorney or by placing limits on the scope of authority. Finally, on House Bill 2537, it would give any agent who has gift-making authority seemingly unlimited default authority to make gifts to charitable organizations to satisfy written pledges executed by the principal. Again, our concern is this might pose a risk to vulnerable principals who make ill-advised pledges as a result of undue influence or emotional frailty. And it would appear that under the current bill as written, it would appear that gifts made to satisfy pledges are not subject to default dollar cap that applies to other gifts. So those are the five concerns. To date, two states, to our knowledge, have enacted the Uniform Act. Those are New Mexico and Idaho. I can tell you that Colorado has just been added to that list. It's waiting for the governor's signature. To my knowledge, the governor there will be signing. I know they're talking to my colleagues in a few other states, in particular Virginia. Hearings are taking place just as you're doing a hearing today. I want to conclude by, again, reiterating our support for the Act, for the bill and for the Act. We're testifying along with many others with particular concerns, but also the message, do not delay any further on trying to perfect perfection here. At least 5 years of my involvement, I know, on various array of stakeholders that have included the bankers and other advocates you're going to be hearing, and we've all shared our goals and concerns. And the fact is that we, certainly speaking for AARP, think the time now is to recognize, don't make the absolute perfect be the enemy of the good. And lastly, I just point out that, back to demographics, today one out of seven Oregonians are age 50 plus. You look around, and in just 11 years, one out of five, and soon after that, perhaps even closer. So the fact is, we are an aging society that all the more reason why we need to both know, be reticent, but be aware of the need to plan ahead, and this provides a tool. Again, I thank you for allowing me to go on record, and hope that the information is of help. And our Director of Government Affairs, Rick Bennett, who's in the audience, will certainly be able to work with you on any follow-up information we can provide.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see if the general. I don't see him.
Lynn Ashcroft, Ralph Monroe, or Merle?
Rudolph,
I'm sorry. And is General Caldwell here?
General Caldwell is not here.
Okay. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Ashcroft. I initially need to disclose that I'm testifying here today as a private citizen. I am offering my testimony in that capacity, and my opinions and comments that I express are not authorized by the Oregon Judicial Department, the Marion County Circuit Courts, or any other individual public body or entity affiliated with the state of Oregon. I'm offering testimony information here today after a review of the bill and discussion of this with other individuals. And just a little background on myself, that I had the privilege to serve in the United States Army and the Oregon National Guard as an enlisted soldier and a commissioned officer. I began serving as a private E1 lowest rank, and I finished my service as a brigadier general. I served on active duty as a lawyer. I served as an infantry officer. I served as an armored cavalry officer. And had a very great experience in the military. I was served as the state judge advocate under two governors, which is one of the only two appointed positions in the National Guard by the governor. I had a practice for many years here in the state of Oregon, practiced primary litigation law, insurance defense law, estate planning, and business support. Had banks as my clients as well. I am a business owner, and I currently serve as an elected Marion County Circuit Court judge. The reason that I wanted to testify here a little bit today is because of some concerns that I observed in my capacity as a judge and also my experience as a soldier. And it was real concern out of that that compelled me to be here today. In civilian life, powers of attorney are somewhat of an exception. I mean, we sign them when we sell a car, giving the car dealer the power of attorney to transfer title. We will give them for health care purposes and benefits, and occasionally we give them for business reasons and purchasing of houses, those types of things. But in the whole scheme of things, when you think about all of the matters that we have, powers of attorney are somewhat the exception to the rule, and what I mean by that is, it's if you had a show of hands in here, how many have outstanding powers of attorney now? I suspect it would be a minority of us. But in the military, they are the rule. Soldiers are required by regulation to execute powers of attorney as a condition of their service and as a condition of their deployment. So when we have our 3,000 or so, 3,500 National Guardsmen deploying to Iraq in this next year, every single one of them, without exception, from a general officer on down, will have executed powers of attorney, and those executed powers of attorney will be distributed to the grantees of those based upon the regulation. And the purpose of that is that the National Guard and the active forces say, we want our soldiers on the line out there to be thinking about the mission. We don't want them to be thinking about what's going on back home. We need to do everything we possibly can. So these powers of attorney provide for such things as who's going to take care of their children in the event there's not another biological parent or legal guardian at that point, who's going to manage their business if that's a circumstance. Anything that that soldier might have to be concerned with, he's required to execute a power of attorney and have it in his file all the time. And they review those annually, if not more often. And I do recognize that over the years, probably any lawyer that's been practicing in litigation law, estate planning, banking law, you're going to have some possible litigation related to powers of attorney. But I have done a lot of litigation, had a very active litigation practice, know a lot of litigation lawyers, and I know of no instance where the issue was something that the acceptor of the power of attorney did. It is generally, did the person have the capacity at the time? Did the person that they granted it to use it for a proper purpose? It's usually the first and third party that are litigating against each other, and rarely is it the bank or that institution, because I saw Mr. Sherman, and I have absolute utmost respect for Mr. Sherman. I don't know that he and I have ever known each other well enough to call ourselves friends, but he's just one of the best lawyers around. My only comment was, if you've got the law that you need on one piece of paper, that's good, you know. And every benefit that I heard that was talked about with the Uniform Act is a benefit we currently have under the law in Oregon. And so the things that have concerned me, and so from that standpoint, from having a uniform form, from having uniform definitions, which all of these are defined under Oregon law as well, I don't have any problem with that, and I applaud that. And for having a uniform manner of having them be executed. But what concerns me particularly about this bill is that banks, businesses, institutions are fiduciaries of these people who are holding their whose funds they hold. They should be the gatekeepers to these funds. And I don't want to see liability exposed to liability where it's not warranted, but I just see so many areas in this bill that create exceptions to the rule from the standpoint of relieving banks and institutions of their liability, that's what concerns me. And so I'll just run through a couple of these. In section 6.64, it allows a photocopy or electronic copy to be as good as the original. And section 10.6 allows validation of the power attorney simply by affidavit of the agent. So one of the red line cardinal, frankly, only rule that I have told people who are giving powers of attorney is make sure that the person you give this to has the original, because the bank or the lending institution or the business is going to want to see that that's a wet copy original. They don't want a photocopy, because photocopies can be forged, they can be changed, they can be modified. It is just too easy to have somebody come in and present a power of attorney that maybe there's a sentence inserted or a paragraph inserted. Maybe the signature is good, maybe everything else is good on the photocopy, but it's the original. I mean, that's the document. It is an incredibly important document. And so we just have some problems with that. It also causes, it also causes concern that, in effect, the agent, the person that I grant the power to, has the ability to say, no, this is good. This is a valid one. Go ahead and take it. All right? That shouldn't be the rule. It should be the grantor that sets the rules for how these things are validated. and what makes them real and what makes them good. And so I have a forged document. I take it into the bank, and it's a photocopy, and somebody questions me, and maybe I have the right ID. Maybe I'm bold enough to be willing to sign that signature card. Maybe I practice it. And if they say, well, Mr. Ashcroft, we kind of question this. Are you sure this is true? Sure, give me a piece of paper. I'll swear an oath that it's true. Okay, we'll accept it. And that, in theory, is available under the law as it's proposed here. You know, and although the bill gives the banks greater discretion than previous versions of powers of attorney, they still remain exposed to the risk and cost of litigation. But usually by the time, and I'll grant you that that is an exposure that the banks may have or that any institution might have, but frankly, the number of times that there is going to be litigation, by the time the litigation gets filed or by the time that the person who is either the agent or the grantor knows about it, the grantor is either dead or back, you know, or available, you know. And so it's just, I mean, I think actual real litigation, extended litigation, to force somebody to honor or accept a power of attorney, I just don't think that is such a realistic concern that it really applies in this case. Section 19.1, a power of attorney is acknowledged and entitled to a presumption of validity if it appears on its face to have been verified before a notary public or other individual authorized to take acknowledgments. 19.3, any person who accepts a power of attorney, even I submit one that is not notarized, but if you accept a power of attorney in good faith and without actual knowledge that the signature is not genuine or that the power of attorney has been revoked or the agent improperly using it, they may rely upon it as if it were valid. So, in effect, they don't even have to make any inquiry. They get a piece of paper, they look at it, it looks good to them, could be a photocopy, they don't have to ask. And if they accept it and rely upon it, they're insulated from liability. And because it goes on to say in subsection 4 that they may, but they're not required, to rely upon it without further investigation from the agent, if an affidavit from the agent asserting that the power of attorney is valid is sufficient. Now, one of the arguments is that, okay, somebody, you know, they're not going to sign this signature card, they're not going to do these types of things. Here's the experience that we fear in the military, they fear in the military. And to give that in context, we have, Colonel Murgo and I, formerly, I guess currently Senior Judge Murgo and I, in our military careers, we have literally drafted and assisted in the execution of tens of thousands of powers of attorney. Did it on active duty as a lawyer, did it in the National Guard as a lawyer over 20-some years. And in active duty, we're not talking about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. We're talking about millions of powers of attorney every single year. Our experience in problems with those powers of attorney are almost zero. Very, very rarely have we been in a situation where there has been somebody that has been unwilling to honor a power of attorney. I mean, for example, as was testified to, 98% of their powers of attorney they accept. Well, if you've got a 98% success rate, that seems pretty good to me. And so let me give you an example of what would be our fear. Our fear would be the forgery, absolutely. We would fear that somebody might get the roster list of all 3,500 soldiers deploying and go down that list and say, well, these guys are out of state. Let's set up a little forgery mill. I'm going to get a power of attorney seal. You're going to sign them. And we're going to, by the time Captain Zupanzik learns that his bank account's empty, they're through the list, all right, because on its face, every single one of those documents appeared valid. But here's the scenario that we fear. An Oregon Guardsman is deployed. As a condition of his deployment, he prepares and executes a power of attorney. Upon leaving the state of Oregon, that power of attorney is distributed to his spouse. While he is deployed and in combat in Iraq or Afghanistan in the field, he served with divorce papers. He goes back to the rear area, gets a judge advocate officer to assist him, and together they contact the courts, and they do two things. One, grant us a stay under the Service Member Civil Relief Act, and two, issue a restraining order to my wife telling her she cannot use my power of attorney. The soldier then writes to his bank and says, here's a letter, I'm revoking my wife's power of attorney, don't ever let her use it again. And here's a copy of the order from the court saying she is restrained from using that. That goes into the bank file or the bank computer. The next day, the spouse walks in with a valid power of attorney on its face and says, I want all the funds out of my husband's separate account in his name that is his inheritance from before we got married, which I don't own any part of. And the teller says, in effect, okay. And the defense to that is that teller had no actual knowledge of the revocation or of the court order. And now I grant it, I'm giving these a strict reading of this statute, but those are the kind of fears that we have. And those are the kind of fears that I have for soldiers, but for all citizens. So what I'm asking is not that we don't have a uniform bill. I think that's great. But in my pessimistic, you know, I view myself as a pessimistic optimist, I guess, but in my pessimistic view of it, this bill appears to me to be primarily a mechanism to insulate lending institutions from any liability at all if they accept a power of attorney. Because in effect, as long as they can say we acted in good faith and on its face this document appeared okay and the teller at our window that took it didn't know that it had been revoked, we're protected. And I don't think that goes enough. The banks are the fiduciary of our bank accounts and of our citizens and of our soldiers. They should be required under a power of attorney, which is potentially far more damaging, they should be required to, at a minimum, impose the same guidelines and restrictions that they do on a cashing their own check. Think about going into a bank and you want to cash a check on your account. You have a bank account at a national banking system and you live here in Oregon and you go to a branch that they don't know you and you're writing on your account in that bank where your money is. They're going to ask you for ID. They're going to see if you have money in the account and they may very well verify your signature that they have on file there. They're not even required to do that much in the powers of attorney. If I were to go into a bank and say, yeah, my name really is Wells Fargo, go ahead and cash this, and I promise it is, they're not going to cash it for me. But if I go in there and say, this power of attorney is good, and on its face it looks good, then under this law, I could force them to take it. And I just think that the safeguards and the exclusions, the protections that are built into this for the person that is the gatekeeper and the fiduciary of our citizens should be a little bit stronger than that. One of the other things that I noticed, and I guess, you know, I'm sure that behind my back here, folks are thinking I'm taking shots at the banking community, but I'm really not. I mean, I think this applies to every business. I mean, think about you go into a 7-Eleven and somebody has a power of attorney with a check, and that business is going to be obligated to the same standards as is the banking group. So one of the other things that was noted to me by another judge was that if you, this is General Caldwell right here. He was out glad-handing other members of the legislature, I'm sure, which he's very good at. If you look at, I think it's Senate Bill or House Bill 3245, and that's also sponsored by the Banking Association, that allows substantially a similar occurrence that if there is a good faith reliance on basically anything from a purported custodian of a minor's account, then the bank can is relieved from any liability. So if you've got a custodian or somebody that purports to be a custodian, I don't know, you're either the custodian or you're not. I'm not sure what purported is. But if they go in and say, I want all this money out of the minor's account, and on its face the documents are correct, they can pull it out. There's no safeguards. And so I'm just asking that some good, strong, hard looks be taken at this because I just think that there are scenarios that the that the Uniform Act doesn't really take into account. I agree that life has changed. But again, all of the safeguards, like the law in Oregon is, that conservator can revoke a power of attorney under the circumstances. There are a number of things that can be revoked. The law is that when somebody dies, the power of attorney is revoked. That's the law in Oregon. So this bill does address issues and does address good issues, but I'm just asking that we look at it more from the standpoint of the citizen and of the individual from their side of the fence rather than from the other side of the fence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Rarely do I get emails over the weekend that have so much energy in them as I did this weekend when this bill was flying around through the Ethernet, and I wouldn't have caught my attention had it not been for the watchful eye of our former head Judge Advocate General for the Oregon National Guard and also a Brigadier General in his own right. So it was a pleasure to see this kind of energy and see the different folks coming in. I'm not going to get to the merits of it because I'm sure you've heard plenty of that by now. I will suggest, and I know probably you've already thought of that, and you're probably going to go that direction, is we would be willing to provide my able-bodied Judge Advocate General to my left to serve on a group if you want to work this thing in a work group before it goes on to final passage. Otherwise, I think we would have grave concerns about what has been brought up, I think, and discussed before I arrive. So that would be our position, and I could answer any questions. I might just add that, unfortunately, we have seen some real unfortunate activities occur with the current law, the way it is, with soldiers and spouses and mothers and fathers and every kind of mix you can imagine, and that's very disappointing. However, it's been limited. It does occur. Anecdotally, we've seen it on two or three occasions. If you probably look at the percentage, it's not high, considering the number of people that we've mobilized, but nevertheless, it happens now under the current system. If we were to make that even less stringent, I think that would be a real mistake. So with that, I'll be quiet and answer any of your questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Colonel?
Sir, Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Rudy Murgo. I'm a citizen soldier. As Judge Ashcroft said, I'm doing Plan B time when I'm not being activated, and I'm currently activated again. I've done a number of powers of attorney. I can't say how many. It's in the thousands, probably more than anybody else in the room other than maybe General Ashcroft. I've been a lawyer since 1975. I've read over the comments of Lynn Ashcroft, Ms. Burton, Ms. Hahn, Ms. Schoen, and Ms. Heinrich, and on behalf of the military, we're in agreement with them. The current bill, as proposed, negatively impacts all Oregonians, but has already been heard, unfairly puts its heaviest toll on its citizen soldiers, whether they're being deployed to places like Hurricane Katrina or abroad. The current bill also appears on its face to conflict with federal law, the Service Members Civil Relief Act, also SCRA, and as General Caldwell has willingly volunteered me, I'd be happy to serve on a study committee to work through some of these issues with you. One of the biggest concerns we have, and unfortunately, even though we counsel soldiers and work with them, sometimes powers of attorneys are abused by people who are spouses, sometimes moms. We've had some moms with gambling addiction, drug addiction, alcohol addiction, who've used their powers of attorney when their children come home, have spent all the money legitimately. This act makes it much more easy, as you'll find out when you hear from others, to create other issues. And again, in terms of creating potential litigation, I'd rather see a study committee work through issues so we don't have a conflict with federal law, which is only going to create more work for the courtrooms. And I know Judge Ashcroft and the judiciary is plenty busy enough without creating yet one more set of court cases to go through the system. The sections that have currently been mentioned by Judge Ashcroft are also of concern to the military. Section 6.4, allowing a photocopy or electronic copy is as good as the original, just seems to be fraught with hazard. I've worked with service members across the globe. We have had no problem getting powers of attorney in the field to people who need them. The world operates at a much different pace than it used to. Global communications is instantaneous. General Caldwell, unfortunately, has a BlackBerry with my number on it, and it goes off whenever he wants to say hi. And the same thing happens to commanders in the field. They may be somewhere and pick a place, and they're going to email me. We have had no issues with this. So sort of in my old past as an old-time country lawyer, if it ain't broke, don't fix this. So we're concerned that we're creating a new liability and bigger issues than we're solving. So, again, let's look at an interim committee from our perspective. The affidavit of an agent, you've heard from Lynn already. He's done a much more eloquent job than I. It needs to be fixed. The other areas he mentioned are of concern. And, again, I had a concern because we use special powers of attorneys a great deal. You've heard from us in the past coming to you with the need to have special powers of attorney for custodian when soldiers are deployed with respect to their minor children and all the family issues. This act doesn't seem to address that. This act doesn't seem to address special powers of attorney. Joe wants to be deployed and he wants his brother John to sell his car while he's deployed. What's this act do for that? He doesn't want John to do everything for him. So, again, there's some concern there. Again, my concern is that one of the speakers speaking for said the act isn't perfect. I agree the act isn't perfect. And I appreciate no law is perfect either. But at this point, the balance is out of whack from the Oregon military members' concern. And as General Caldwell has volunteered me, or as we say in the military, throw me under the bus, I'd be happy to volunteer to help and answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Ashcroft, question. First, I picked... this question directed at you in large part because it's always a lot of fun when I get to ask questions of judges. It's not something I get to do every day.
When a lawyer asks me a question, I say, does he really think I'm that stupid?
So I appreciate your testimony, and also I agree with you about the purpose of this bill, i.e. for financial institutions to limit exposure to liability. At the same time, that's not necessarily offensive to me. I'm assuming that you would not advocate for a strict liability regime.
No, absolutely not.
But so essentially what this act is trying to do is essentially put in a series of bright line rules what the duty of reasonable care is for financial institution in accepting these. And I'm wondering is it the rules themselves that you object to, i.e. such that, or is it the attempt to essentially establish a series of bright line rules?
Absolutely not. I think the bright line rules are a good idea. Bright line rules are always great ideas. I mean, if we had bright line rules in all the law, we would not have a Supreme Court and a Court of Appeals up here for the most part. May not even have many judges, okay? So I don't disagree with that at all. My biggest concern is the potential that this law allows for greater abuse by valid power of attorney holders. And what I mean by that, they started out valid, but for some reason they've turned invalid, they're revoked or something. And it allows for the greater potential for fraud by allowing, and I'm not saying that there isn't an alternative to having the original in every case. Maybe there is one. But the way I read this is that, you know, if it just gives, in my opinion, and I'm going to say the banks, but it's not just the bank. It would be every institution that might rely upon a power of attorney. It gives too great of an ability to say, well, I acted in good faith. I mean, I didn't see any problem with it, or I didn't know that it had been revoked. And so I think if we get to the point where if the bright line rules were, and I'll go the opposite direction, that you can only use a rely upon a document that is in fact signed in ink and you see the signature, and you must identify that this is the person, and you must check your records to see if you had a revocation, you know, things like that, and if they do all those things, then yeah, there should be some insulation there for them. But I think to just put the burden, or excuse me, put the discretion on them, on the receiver of the power of attorney to say, well, I didn't see anything wrong with it, I just don't think that's fair to their account holder or to their other person. And so bright line rules are great, but let's make them equal.
A brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. I recognize we're starting to run short on time. I can understand the frustration. It seems that currently this area of law is governed in large part by standards, and I can understand the frustration of the lending institutions and their wanting to clarify.
I can, too.
And I can also understand that any set of bright-line rules, of course, by its nature, any judicial rules, are over- and under-inclusive. And so there will always probably inevitably be situations in which we are weakening the current area of law and its standards-based approach. And I'm wondering, do you think we can overcome it?
Yeah. I don't think we can weaken mm-hmm. our current area of law. And the only thing that we might weaken would be who's going to be held accountable for somebody not doing their due diligence. And should it be the person whose money it is we're working at when they did everything they were supposed to do? Or should it be the person who is going to rely upon it? I mean, I guess I'm not so certain from my personal standpoint that the law mandating that if you've done these things you must accept the power of attorney, I don't think that I personally would require that. But I think that if they are going to rely upon the power of attorney, and if they are going to let that power of attorney be executed, that they need to do more than just say, I didn't know. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you.
Oops. Oh, your new desk. But that was made by a state
worker. Mary Gear, Annie Sean, Vic Dahan, and Elizabeth Kushwa, please. Please go ahead in any order and just introduce yourself for the record. Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Annie Schoen. It's S-H-O-E-N. I'm from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office.
I'm Elizabeth Kushwa, representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association, and I'm just here for the purposes of introducing to the committee testimony from Judge Claudia Burton from Marion County and from Stephen Heinrich, who's an attorney in private practice for elder law in Corvallis. I'd just like to point out to the committee that attached to Judge Burton's testimony are three attachments, one from the District of Columbia, one from New York, and one from the Contra Costa Times, detailing fraudulent uses of POAs, as well as I'd be happy to talk to you about additional recent cases here in Crook County in Oregon, which have resulted from fraudulent uses of powers of attorney. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Mary Gear. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. My office has responsibility for the program and policy for adult protective services statewide. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2537. The department supports the intention of this bill, which is to come up with some uniformity and portability of powers of attorney, and certainly appreciate the leadership that the Bankers Association has taken, especially on the issue of financial exploitation. We're very pleased to have worked with the Bankers Association and other stakeholders to develop a training for bank tellers about financial exploitation and what to look for. Currently, financial exploitation is the fastest growing area of elder abuse that we are investigating. Our caseloads have increased over the last 5 years, and this is the area where we are spending much of our time. There are several areas of the bill that we have concern about, and those are outlined in my written testimony. Just briefly, I'd like to go over them. The definition of incapacity in this bill is very broad. We have a tradition in the state, much supported by the department, of using guardianship and conservatorship power of attorney in very limited situations, and are concerned that a very broad definition of incapacity would lead to situations where the power of attorney might be invoked inappropriately. In addition, there is a definition for incapacity that is in the guardianship statute or the elder abuse statute for guardianship in ORS 125, and these don't quite match, and so we're concerned about some conflict there. The second area of concern for us has to do with compensation of the powers of attorney. The bill gives the power of attorney the ability to compensate themselves for their role, for their work. It is not uncommon for Adult Protective Services to get a call in a situation where there is a fiduciary who has paid themselves before they've paid for the maintenance of the person that they're representing, which in many cases can put the placement, if it's in a long-term care facility or paying caregivers, can put the health and well-being of the principal that they represent in jeopardy. And so we'd really like some clarity around that language, specifying under what circumstances a power of attorney can reimburse themselves, and have suggested that we look at the Social Security Act language regarding rep payees. Third, the bill allows a power of attorney to resign at will and to notify, among others, the department when they're resigning. We are concerned about this primarily because we're uncertain of the fiscal impact on the department as far as the reporting requirement. And last, there's been much testimony about the liability of the banks, and so I won't go into that much, just to say that we do share that concern and have certainly been involved in cases where powers of attorney have been used inappropriately for purposes of financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. As I said, we do want to be supportive of this bill. We've shared our concerns with the folks who have drafted it, have met with them, and will continue to meet with them to come up with some language that we can agree on to help move this forward. And having said that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is similar to Representative Barton's question, or at least in the same category. Do you have a judgment about whether, let me back up half a step, some of our legal architecture is more standard-like, right? It's sort of a simple rule, Sherman Antitrust Act, and then we do lots of regulations or lots of judge-made law or lots of interpretation of it afterwards. And much of our law, much of our legal architecture is more rule-like, where the legislature delineates lots of provisions and prescriptions. Do you have a preference about whether this is a place that actually makes sense to be a little more standard-like, less delineated and prescribed? That's the first question, question part A. Question part B is, or if you think it should be more delineated, are you just saying we need different delineations? Any y'all can take
on that out there? Okay, this is Annie Schoen. I'm from the DA's office in Multnomah County again. On part A, I think it is a good area to have a lot of rules and regulations as opposed to just judge-made case law. I think that is a good idea. And I support the idea of a Uniform Power of Attorney Act. I think it's a great idea. But on to part B, I don't think this is it.
Is that roughly the view shared by everybody, or is there anybody who thinks, nah, this is a better place or a little more in the soup?
Chair Barker and Representative Smith, as far as the department goes, we don't have an opinion on what the legal structure should be. In general, we tend to find in situations where there's been exploitation, if the law is clear and there is some uniformity to a power of attorney that can be used in this state or in other states for the portability, that would be helpful for the folks who are needing to use that. But, you know, again, it's the balance of how do you make sure that then can't be used for financial exploitation, which is what we tend to see.
Thank you.
Yes, anything further?
And again, Chair Barker, thank you very much for having me here today. Annie Schoen again. I have a lot of concerns about this act, and I will say right off the bat that most of these concerns were raised at the work group by many of the participants there. To begin with, I should tell you that at the Multnomah County DA's office, what I do is I'm the elder abuse deputy. I've had this position for about 6 months, so not very long, but I deal with a lot of elderly people in that capacity. In fact, I get calls every day from elderly people, and I think what we need to keep in mind when we're looking at this is they deal with certain limitations that we don't deal with on a daily basis, and frankly, soldiers don't deal with on a daily basis. And they can present well for a certain period of time. So I get a lot of calls from people who say, hello, Ms. Schoen, this is Ms. Smith, and I'd like to talk to you about my grandson. So we talk about her grandson, and 5 minutes later, she asks me if I represent her grandson and who I am and why she called me. So as far as having the notary be the person, and this is what this bill does, who kind of guarantees capacity, that notary is going to spend maybe, 30 seconds with this principal. And they're going to have no idea whether or not the principal has capacity or not. So while that principal may represent for maybe, you know, that 30 seconds that she or he knows what they're doing, it's not going to last very long, and they're going to leave the room, and again, they're going to have no idea what they just did. And that's part of the problem with this. A lot of people who are signing these and basically handing away the keys to their life savings are going to not know exactly what they're doing because they don't have capacity. And there are absolutely no safeguards in this bill to prevent that. I'm not as concerned with the people, the elderly people or the people signing these who have attorneys. And I understand that there is a desire to do a uniform power of attorney that banks are more uniformly accepting, although it sounds like they're accepting 98% of them right now. So I didn't realize the number was that high. But who I'm concerned about are the victims that I see, the ones who don't have attorneys, the ones who can't afford attorneys. You know, they don't have a lot of money, but maybe they've got $300,000 in their house. So this is the perfect opportunity. Basically, this bill would make fraud so much easier. All you would do is you go, you get one of these, you forge it, you forge the notary, you bring it down to the bank, and you empty out that bank account, or frankly, you take out a loan, or you sign the house over to yourself. Any of that can be done easily. There are no guarantees to keep that from happening. Now, going back to Representative Barton's question, is there a way that that can be fixed? Can this be worked into the bill? The answer is yes, and several ideas were presented, including attorney certification. There are many attorneys in the state. We are all members of a bar association, and that bar number is really important to all of us. So before we sign a certification saying, I certify that I believe this person has capacity, I think they know what they're doing, and the person who's signing here is the agent, that is truly their agent, and they do want to give this power of attorney to that agent. Before they sign that, they're going to make sure that that is happening. And then the bank has an easy method of just calling that attorney up and saying, hello, did you sign this power of attorney? Make sure it's not forged. The attorney can either say, yes, I certified that power of attorney, or no, I did not certify that power of attorney. And it could go from there. So there are ways to fix it, and they're frankly not that difficult, and they could be written into the bill, but they're just not there. I would be much more comfortable with having an attorney certify these powers of attorney as opposed to a notary. I can tell you I looked online today to try to determine how hard it is to become a notary, and it's really not that difficult at all. It's a 3-hour class. And then a very brief test. So those are some of my concerns. Really, I'm here for the elderly victims. I can't tell you how many cases I've had. Not as many involving POAs, and from a criminal standpoint, it's very, very difficult to prove fraud with a POA because the defendant just comes in, and I had this defendant by the name of Ray Nordmeyer. His mom, Ruth Nordmeyer, lived down in Florida. He was her POA. And he decided to take her money and open a gym here in Northwest Portland, which he did, and the gym tanked. And Ruth, she was no longer getting money to pay her fees down at her facility, and she was kicked out. And his defense when he came in, and his attorney told me this, is, hey, this is what she wanted. She told him that she wanted him to invest the money. That's what she would have wanted. So he was acting in her best interest. She wanted him to invest it in his gym. And there was really, it was very difficult for me to defeat that defense. We ultimately did by coming to a plea deal where he didn't end up having to go to prison, and he's supposed to be paying back the money monthly. But, and that's just one of the defenses that you're going to see more and more with this power of attorney bill. So I have a lot of other concerns, but I think they are really, they're addressed fairly thoroughly in a lot of the written testimony. The main thing I wanted to say is that I understand why we're doing this. I think it's important. I think it can be fixed, but I think that this really takes the responsibility from the party accepting the POA. It takes the responsibility away from them to do due diligence. And it does. It changes the law in that area, whereas before I think they could have been held liable, and there's case law to support that. Now they can't be held liable, and I think that's a problem. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bina Hahn, and I work as a deputy district attorney at the Washington County District Attorney's Office. I have been a deputy DA for the past 8.5 years, and for the past 5 years, I've been assigned to the Elder Abuse Unit, and for the past 3 years or so, I've been assigned to the FITE team, which stands for Fraud and Identity Theft Enforcement Team, which deals with large-scale fraud that occurs in our county. I can tell you off the bat that even though I'm assigned to these two units, I am not assigned specifically to these types of cases. I prosecute all cases, whether it be related to fraud or domestic violence, but my focus became elder abuse and with fraud with being assigned to these teams. I can tell you that this bill will be detrimental to not only seniors and our elders, but to vulnerable adults as well. And I know this based upon my experience as a deputy DA for the past 8.5 years. What this bill essentially does, it gives a very powerful grant of authority, a power of attorney, and it gives it a very low threshold when it comes to a presumption of validity. So what this bill essentially does is, with a very low threshold of a burden, a person is able to get a power of attorney that, as long as you use a uniform power of attorney form and as long as you can find a notary and two witnesses, that it's presumptively valid. And I feel that that is very dangerous and detrimental to seniors and to vulnerable adults. I can tell you that when it comes to this bill, there really is no competency when it comes to determining, or there is no guidance when it comes to determining competency. If you look at the bill, it says that basically as long as someone is competent and the witness must certify that the principal is competent, then the power of attorney is considered valid. Who determines that the principal is competent? Basically, it's the agent and the witnesses. If the agent and the witnesses are conspiring along with the notary to defraud this principal, then it is very easy to have a presumptively valid power of attorney document that can pass the muster of a lot of bankers. And I feel that that would be wholeheartedly inappropriate. Basically, this bill has no checks and balances when it comes to protecting our elders and our vulnerable adults. Because, again, as long as anyone determines that the principal is competent, then it's presumptively valid so long as it's done on the uniform power of attorney form. I feel that would be dangerous as well. I also feel that this bill hurts our bankers, and this is the reason why. I operate under the presumption that our bankers are our first responders when it comes to elder abuse. They're on the front lines. And I also operate under the presumption, because of my personal experience, that bankers want to protect their customers. Bankers are not a faceless person. I've met everyday bankers who come and who testify in our cases, in grand juries, who talk to me, and they care about their customers, just like all of you care about your constituents, very much so. And to have this bill in place would basically tie the hands of bankers. I have been privileged to work with some of the best banking investigators, I believe, in our county. Some of them work for U.S. Bank, and I've had a great relationship with them. And I can tell you that their hands would be tied when it comes to many of the fraud and issues that come up with this type of power of attorneys. Now, this type of power of attorney also does not address the issue of undue influence. Undue influence does exist. and unfortunately it does run rampant in the population of our elders, and it's not fair, but that's just how it is. Unfortunately, the elders are much more susceptible to exploitation and to undue influence than those of us who may not. I believe that this bill should take into consideration of some type of a directive to mandate bankers to report to law enforcement and a mandate to not accept. Currently, as the bill stands now, under Section 20, subsection 5, it states that a person is not required to accept an acknowledged statutory form of power of attorney. I believe that language simply provides a relief. And really, the rest of Section 20 mandates that they accept a power of attorney or they're subject to liability. So this should be changed, that there be a directive so that they not accept power of attorney if these circumstances exist, as outlined in this section. And one of the reasons why is because in the example that one of the bankers gave, the one where the son attempted to use his mother's power of attorney while she was on vacation, I believe under that example, most bankers would be in a very difficult position because the supervisor may say, okay, well, do you feel in good faith that this power of attorney should be honored? Now, what does it mean to have good faith? That banker is going to say, well, I have a feeling. I just have a feeling. Are they going to feel like that feeling is sufficient to support them denying this presumptively valid power of attorney? And I would say some bankers might say yes, some bankers might say no. Now, a threat of a lawsuit and a threat of a liability is something that nobody wants hanging over their head. I know of nobody who wants a lawsuit filed against them. And so I believe ordinary citizens who are bankers, who are going to read this, are going to err on the side of accepting presumptively valid power of attorneys. I also know this because when I talk to ordinary citizens like bankers or those in the medical field or any type of profession, whenever I tell them who I am and that I'm an attorney, I get a lot of, I'll call you back, let me talk to my supervisor, let me have them talk to you, so on and so forth, because people simply don't like the idea of being liable for something or doing something that breaks the law. And this Power of Attorney Uniform Act, I believe, basically, I guess, fuels the fire when it comes to those type of fears. Also, the idea that there are mechanisms in place to protect fraud, I believe, is not correct. This bill invites fraud. Basically, now you have formed a template for anybody who wants to scam or fraud to simply use. And if you think that people who defraud and who scam operate alone, that is a misnomer. I can tell you for a fact that people who defraud and scam operate in large rings of fraud circles. They have multiple friends, some of whom are notaries, some of whom have positions that you might be surprised at, and they use those advantages for purpose of perpetuating their scam. What we do with this bill is we're basically giving the ones who scam, the ones who defraud, a powerful tool in having a presumptively valid power of attorney given to them with a very low threshold. I'll wrap it up because I see that we're getting close to 3 o'clock. It's been said that we can't prevent bad actors from doing whatever deeds they want to do, and that is true, but we can prevent putting powerful tools in their hands, and this would be a powerful tool for those who fraud. For any of you who believe that perhaps this bill is detrimental only to elders, and that's why we're speaking out against it. I'm speaking out against it not only because I feel it's detrimental to our elders, to vulnerable adults, but to anybody who ever has any type of financial interest, and that's me and that's all of you. And if any of you have used your debit card or given your information, your personal information, to anybody in the past 5 or 10 years of your life, you are all in danger of being victims of fraud. And this bill would basically aid whoever is looking out to defraud you, would give them a powerful weapon. And in closing, unfortunately, those who defraud, those who are criminals, they're always one step ahead of us because that's all they think about. Whereas we have other things to think about. All they do is think about defrauding. If you saw how sophisticated they were in thinking of scams, you'd be shocked. If I showed you some paycheck, you would swear that it was valid, but it's not. They're all forgeries. They can create them. They're one step ahead of us. And to give them an extra weapon, I don't think is constructive of us at all. Thank you very much.
There's been a lot of work done in this bill. There obviously needs to be some more. The military pointed out some real problems. You have as well. So, and I hope we can get those resolved, not in the interim, but before we're done this session, and have a good bill come out here. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2537. Committee's adjourned.